But thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you also for inviting me to come here. It was an opportunity. I was in Rochester in a conference this week, so I took the opportunity to come for today, which is a great pleasure. So my name is Bertamo. I work in this laboratory, which is a CNRS laboratory in France. It's in a town called Marcoussis, which is near Paris, where we have a group working experimentally on polaritons. Actually, in Paris, there are several groups working on polaritons. There is the group of Alberto Gramatti working on polaritons in the center of Paris experimentally, a group in Ecole Normale Supérieure also, and then there are several theoretical groups working on polaritons. So it's a strong activity of polaritons in France, and in particular around Paris. So first of all, I would like to acknowledge all the people who have participated in this work. So the experimental work was done both in the group of Alberto Gramatti and in the group of Jacqueline Bloch, where I work, with support from Daniel Sanvitos and on the experimental side. And these people participated strongly, all these people in the theory that is related to the experiments I'm going to show. And I would also like to thank particularly Anatoly Kanchanov, who helped me understand many things related to the topological excitations that we have observed in polarity. Okay. So I would like first to introduce the system, because as Nathan has been giving a talk, even though I think that David Snock was here last week, and probably he already told you a lot about polaritons, I would like just to introduce you to the system. So this is the kind of structure we are looking at. So these are semiconductor structures, in which we can find both photons and excitons. So I will try to explain you how we do this. So the first ingredient of these microstructures are the photons, that they combine photons. And in order to combine them in this planar structure, what we do is we grow two Bragg mirrors. So Bragg mirrors are just a material in which we put the layers of two different materials of different index of refraction with a given periodicity, and this conforms a gives rise to a very, very good mirror, much better than a metallic mirror, with very high reflectivities. So when we put two of them like that, with a spacer in between, we can confine a photon mode here, cavity mode, and these photons that are confined in these mirrors can move freely in this direction. And actually, by confining the photons inside these cavities, we give an effective mass to the photons. So you can see this is the dispersion of the photons confined in this cavity. This is the implant momentum, and this is the energy. And they gain a mass. They result in a mass. This mass is very small. It's on the order of 10 to the minus 5 the mass of the electron. Okay, so they are free to move in this plane. So the second element that we have in these microcavities is the exciton, is the matter excitation. So these excitons that we are dealing with are quantum well excitons. So basically what we do is we put we take two materials, two semiconductor materials of different band gap. This is one material, this is another material, and in between we sandwich another material with a smaller band gap, as you can see here. So this direction here is now going to be here, this direction. This is where the quantum wells are located. And these quantum wells have very strong optical properties, very interesting optical properties. So basically, when we have a photon, it excites an electron from the valence band to the conduction band, and this leaves behind a hole in the valence band, which we call hole, and has a positive charge. And this electron falls into this quantum well, which where it is confined. These are the confined levels. The hole, the same thing, and they attract each other because they have opposite charges, and they give rise to this particle, which is like a hydrogen-like particle, the exciton. And after a given time, the electron goes back to the conduction band, annihilates the hole, and emits a photon. Okay. So these are the two ingredients, and very important, I must tell you, the mass of the exciton is basically the mass of the electrons here, and it's very, very heavy compared to the mass of the photon here. So in this image that you see here, the exciton looks like has a flat dispersion. Okay. Now when we put both together, so we have our photon confined, the exciton absorbs the photon is re-emitted, it bounces back, it's reabsorbed, re-emitted, and this interaction is so strong that we cannot longer talk about excitons or photons separately, but we need to talk about these mixed excitations, which are polaritons, which are arises from the normal mode coupling of these two particles. And then the dispersion of these of the polaritons is has this shape here. Okay, so it has a very particular shape with an inflection point. It has a very low mass, that's like I will see you before. And very very nicely, we can address optically these polaritons in a very nice way. So basically, the in-plane momentum must be conserved, and when a photon escapes out of the cavity, because the cavity is not perfect, coming from a polariton, this photon will keep all the information related to the polariton, mainly the in-plane momentum, and the in-plane momentum will be related to the angle of emission of the photon. Okay, so the properties of these particles, the polaritons, are listed here. So they are bosons. They have atomic part, and as I told you, this gives rise to this very low mass, which is 10 to the minus 5, the mass of the electron. They have a short lifetime, on below 100 picoseconds, and this lifetime actually comes from the fact that the polaritons escape out of the cavity in the form of photons, as a projection in the form of photons. And these photons have all the information, as I told you, of the polariton gas that we will create here. And so they will give us information on their energy, their momentum, their spatial distribution, their coherence, etc. And very importantly, the heatonic component provides these polaritons with very strong interactions. And actually, this is, I would say, one of the major interests of this polariton. So both the fact that they are out of equilibrium due to the continuous escape of photons and the strong interaction. Okay. So as I was telling you, these particles are bosons. They are composite bosons because the excitons are composite bosons and the photons are bosons by themselves. And as they have a very low mass, it has been speculated and then demonstrated experimentally that they can condense, they can form a Gaussian condensate. And this is the way that these condensates are formed. So basically, you pump the system out of resonance, so at very high energy, with an optical excitation. You create electrons and holes here. These electrons and holes form excitons, which relax to this reservoir level that we call reservoir, and then they relax back again, like again down to the bottom of the polariton branch, or the polariton branches, and when the occupation is above one, we have a condensate. And this is exactly what was observed in this experiment in 2006 by the group of Benoit Debon in Lausanne, and also by some other, by other groups. This is the group of Snoke, in which they observed the condensation in momentum space in exactly the same the way I just explained. So they see that by increasing the excitation density, they see above a given density which is higher than the density given by the wavelength of the particles, they see accumulation in a single quantum state at the bottom of the band, and they have a condensation. Okay, and I will not go into the details of this condensate, but it has coherence properties, it has spontaneous formation of polarization and other properties. I would like to just to mention.
Can I ask a question? So there's it's at 5 Kelvin?
Yes.
So how are these, the idea is somehow the temperature is set by what, by the temp? Because it seems like it's a pretty non-equilibrium sort of a
yes, so thing. Actually, if you want to do the analogy with the, it's not an analogy, it's really the way it is. So here's the de Broglie wavelength that you have in atoms when you form a condensate. So you need to have an interparticle distance smaller than the de Broglie wavelength to have a condensate. This is conceptually what you need. Here, actually, the de Broglie wavelength is given by the photon mode size, the mode size of the photons in your system. So so by increasing the fineness of the cavity, so by making the photons having a larger special size, you can actually you define the density at which the polaritons can condense. So actually, this temperature is not really that important because it's really the photonic size, the photonic element which creates the temperature. But this is how I see. Maybe Jonathan will have another opinion.
How does the exciton size compare to the exciton spacing?
Well, the excitons are very small, so they have a size of 10 nanometers, okay? But you should remember that we don't have excitons anymore, we have the hybrid particle. So it's really the photonic part which is given the size, which is much bigger. Yeah. So these temperatures that I show you here are just are used because for some technical reasons, which is basically that at higher temperatures, there are no excitons in the system. So you need excitons to exist and dividing energies are such that you need these temperatures for them to exist. But this is in a carbon telluride microgravity. All the results I'm going to tell you are in a gallium arsenide microgravity. But there are microgravities in other materials, like gallium nitride, which have a very wide band gap. And excitons have a stronger binding energy. And these observations have been reported at room temperature. OK. So I'm very much interested also in the nonlinear properties of polarizers. And there have been a plethora of observations related to the nonlinear properties. Some of them are listed here. So for instance, they have been shown a very strong optical parametric oscillation with nonlinearities, Chi3 nonlinearities, related Chi3 nonlinearities, which are world record actually. So quantized vortices, long range of the phases are a bit exotic, like B-type condensation or P-type condensation. Arrays of BECs, bright solitons, also coherent propagation of this of polariton with packets. And they have been recent observations in which they condense simultaneously polaritons in this harmonic-like potential. As I can see, as you can see here. But polaritons also have another ingredient that I have not talked about yet, which is the spin. They have a spin degree of freedom, and there are also many interesting things going on with the spin, like, for instance, the spin multistability or polarization multistability, what have vortices, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that, spin rings, spin precession over macroscopic distances, spin switches, many things. Okay. So this is the outline of my talk. So I'm going to be interested on the, of course, in the out of equilibrium properties of the system, but particularly in the nonlinear effects and in the nonlinear effects in the hydrodynamic regime. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the formation of hydrodynamic excitations, like solitons and vortex strips. And then in the second part, I will talk about the spin degree of freedom, and how these hydrodynamic excitations change with when you include the spin. And I'm going not mainly to talk about these excitations, which are half solitons, which behave like magnetic monopoles. Okay. So one very convenient way to study these polariton gases in order to address the aerodynamic properties is by exciting them resonantly. So take a laser, you put them at the right angle going into the cavity. So you have you inject polaritons with a well-defined momentum, and then you look at the gas in a transmission experiment typically. So we look from behind the sample, and then we have this is not a near field camera, it's a real space camera and a far field camera, which will allow us to observe the momentum distribution and the real space density. Okay, so in this way we can control the energy of the condensate, we can control the momentum, the density, everything, and this will be very convenient. So in this configuration, the way we describe the system is by this nonlinear Schrödinger equation that I put here, in which basically it has the shape of a Kruspi-Tayoski equation, in which there are some differences. So first one is this one. So we don't have a particle with a parabolic dispersion. It has this particular dispersion. But actually, in the place where we are working here, in the lower polariton branch, it doesn't really matter. So we can actually consider that our particles have a mass, a very low mass. So we could put here a Laplacian. We have a potential. We will put our gas in the presence of a potential. We have the interactions, which are in this term. And we have the decay of the particles, and also our pump, which is continuously pumping the system. Actually, as we have losses, we need to pump continuously the system, and the steady state is obtained by the interplay between the pump and the losses. Okay.
The kinetic term is where?
The kinetic energy term is here. Sorry, I just put it like that. But this should be the Laplacian. But I just wanted to put it like this to have a generalized form in which you can include the full dispersion.
So both dipoles and also light somehow they have low range forces. So what's the justification for generalized form? I've seen that equation many times, but especially for polaritons, it's never clear why am I justified it. So just throwing away all the 1/r some power term.
They are to some power term.
Well, dipole interaction.
Okay. Well, yes, you're right. We make an approximation of having like just a contact interaction between the particles. Yeah. Okay. But well, it works. It works very well. So as you will see. But there are also yes. I don't know. It works very well. But, I haven't seen yet any effect which in a mean field experiment, in an experiment in which address the system in a mean field way, in which this you cannot describe interactions in this way as a contact interaction, repulsive contact interaction. Okay, so in this condition, when you can use this equation, there was this this work here by Carusotto and Chuti, in which they analyzed this equation, the steady states of this equation, and the response to perturbations to this equation, and they proposed a way to address to observe superfluidity in a system which is ruled by this equation. And I must say that there are also these works here by Chao, actually, in the early 2000s, in which he also proposed the same kind of thing. Instead of using polaritons, he was using exactly the same equation, but just using a chi-3 medium, which in a chi-3 medium, nonlinear medium, you have the same equation, basically, governing the dynamics of your photons. So the idea is that if you put your polariton fluid in presence of an obstacle, and this is the obstacle here, they made the calculations on the spectrum of excitations of the system, and what they see is at a low excitation density, low power, this term doesn't play any role, you have your fluid going down, encountering the obstacle, and being scattered back by the obstacle, and then you have these wavefronts here, which are parabolic, and which show the fact that the polaritons are just scattered from the obstacle. So the interference between the polaritons which are going down, that we are injecting, and the scattered polaritons, give rise to this interference wavefront. And if you look at the spectrum of excitations, and pumping polaritons here with this momentum, basically they have the single particle spectrum of excitations, and scattering takes place to these states here, so to these states, etc. But at high density, this changes significantly. So basically what you have is a renormalization of your dispersion, and also a linearization of the dispersion, as you can see here. So now that your polariton gas, and this comes from this term, the polariton gas is sitting at this point, and elastic scattering is forbidden, just because there are no final states where you can scatter. So then when you have an obstacle, you just go around it without scattering. And this is a regime that they identified with superfluidity. You can create your fluid with a higher velocity, and well, let me tell you that the slope of this spectrum of excitation actually defines a sound velocity, an effective sound velocity. So if you create your fluid with a high velocity, which is higher than this sound velocity, you are in this situation. You still have the renormalization, you have the linearization, but now there are points to which you can scatter elastically. And this is what happens here. So you have the obstacle, where it can scatter elastically to this point, but the scattering pattern has changed significantly from this case. So this is what we call the supersonic regime, which gives rise to these linear wavefronts arising from these strong modifications of the spectrum of excitations at high density and high velocity. So basically, we did an experiment in which we proved these three regimes in the way I explained you in transmission in a transmission experiment. We found an obstacle, which was a photonic defect present in our microcavity, and the polariton gas just scattered against this photonic defect, and by changing the density and also the velocity, we could observe these three regimes. Okay. So once we observed that, we were interested actually into looking in, into the nucleation of topological excitations in this fluid, and actually the nucleation of topological excitations in the hydrodynamic regime. So just when you have your river of water, you put a stone in the middle, and this perturbation will nucleate some topological excitations in your system. So in the quantum case, when you have a quantum fluid like this one, we were interested in understanding how we can do this. And so this is the idea. You have your obstacle, and behind the obstacle, in the wake of the obstacle, you create transverse currents in the fluid, and these transverse currents will generate some topological excitation. So in order to create transverse currents, you need to allow your system to develop a gradient in the phase in the transverse direction. So this is not what I was showing you in the previous experiments, because in the previous experiments I was excecting the system resonantly with my laser, resonantly. So my laser was here, my laser spot was here, and my laser was imprinting the phase into the condens. So the phase was like that, given by the laser. These are the a sketch of the phase equal phase points here. So there is a phase gradient in this direction with this velocity in this direction, but I cannot nucleate the topological excitations in the wake because I don't provide the fluid with the freedom of developing transverse currents. So in order to observe the nucleation of this topological excitation, what I need to do is to let the fluid have this freedom to develop this transverse current.
If I imprinted that phase and then turned off the laser, immediately after you turn off the laser, the fluid is moving. Right? So immediately in the aftermath of turning it off, that picture should.
Yes, it's correct. And this, this is exactly what Chow, in the papers I showed you before, was proposing to do in a microcavity with a Cri3 nonlinear medium. To do that, to have the laser, switch it off, and then see what happens afterwards. And as long as you have particles in the system, because they are escaping all the time, you will be able to see that. Okay.
Presumably also, if the laser power is not too strong, there will be a crossover from...
Right.
If laser power is weak, you won't be able to force the fluid to have a well-defined phase. Is that right?
Yes, right. It's correct. Mm-hmm. So if your laser power is low enough, is too low, you don't have interactions. So the dynamics around the obstacle will be very different. Yes. Okay. So this is what we do in this experiment here. So we are injecting, instead of doing what you say, which is hard to do for us, also because the lifetime of this cavities, the lifetime of the particle in this cavity is very short, it's on the order of 10 picoseconds. So we will need to look very fast afterwards, which is it's possible to do, but challenging. So what we do is to always in the CW regime, in the steady state regime, we pump above this red line here. So this is where our laser is. We're pumping here. Polaritons are escaping the region in which the laser is located, and they're free to propagate afterwards. And we also, for instance, this regime at very high excitation density. So at very high excitation density, this is the obstacle. We are in a superfluid regime. So polaritons now, in the same way as I asked before, they flow around the obstacle. Okay. And this can be seen also, well, because here you see an homogeneous density. But also you look at this interferometric experiment, so we just make interfere this density coming out of, light density coming out of the sample with a reference beam of homogeneous phase. What we see is this interference pattern, which is quite homogeneous, so showing that there are no topological excitations. And also, if we look at the visibility of the fringes here, we see that the fluid is very highly coherent. So it fits well the supersuite picture.
What's the condensate fraction here? Do you know?
Yes, actually, condensate fraction is a question that I think Jonathan will address in more detail. But I would say that the condensate fraction here is 100%, or close to 100%, because you cannot define a temperature in under the conditions I'm showing you here. I don't believe you can define a temperature. You have almost all your particles in the superfluid mode, okay? And in the mode that you are in, which you see all these things. So I'm not sure what is the condensate fraction. I mean,
so you're saying the fraction of particles in other modes is tiny.
Yes. Well, maybe here you would have some. You will nucleate topological excitations which will be out of the superfluid, and you will not be in the superfluid, so maybe you can define a condensate fraction. Maybe there's something we can discuss afterwards, because I would also like to understand better how you can apply this picture to this.
This is two-dimensional, right?
Yes.
So you should always have some excitations.
Because
you cannot have
true, but it's
that's
true.
That's true.
It's too late, I think. It's also quite small.
Does it guarantee that
maybe you already said that. How do you make the obstacle with another laser?
No, you can make it with another laser by blue shifting the system. But this one is an accidental defect in the structure of the sample.
So you have no control.
Not in this experiment, but we can control it. We have shown it. We can do it by at will if we want. But this one are very nice because they're very sharp. So when you do it optically, they're not so sharp. So that's why I'm here.
How big is it?
So it's below 10 microns.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here in this situation, where we reduce the excitation density, which means we reduce the interaction energy. So now the kinetic energy starts to be comparable to the interaction energy. So then we observe the nucleation of something in the wake of the obstacle. So you see these two dark lines here, and when you look at interferometric images, there are some phase dislocations. In this case, these locations are usually a signature in this way, signature of the formation of vortices. And when you look at the coherence, you see that there are these lines, these straight lines here, these lines, in which the coherence is very small, very low. And the way we interpret this is that actually we have continuous nucleation of vortices in the wake of the obstacle due to this transfer currents that form in the wake. These vortices are circulating continuously here. And when we make the interferometric image of that with continuous circulation of vortices with a static beam, reference beam, which a static phase, in the places where the vortices are circulating, the phase is not well defined, so it gives rise to this very low visibility here.
What does control the angle? That angle between those two lines.
Well, it's very much related. It should be very much related to the ratio between the fluid speed and the sound speed. But so it's basically that. If we decrease the excitation density, but there's an important point here. Here you can see it already here. And this is a logarithmic scale. The density at this point is very different to the density at this point. Eh? So you want to define a sound speed related to the density using this expression. The sound speed here it will be very different to the sound speed here. Okay? So this is another particularity of this system compared to, for instance, atomic condensates. Even though in atomic condensates, when you have a parabolic trap, you also have a similar problem. Eh? Even so, I just wanted to show you this in a different experiment. This is a time resolved experiment. This is done by a group of Enmar et Bo, and I picked it up because it's very clear. So basically, they inject this in the same configuration with a pulse laser, and they will see the formation of vortices. So here, this is the density, and now there are two dark points here, which are the formation of the vortices. It's not very clear in the density, but it's very clear in the phase. This is the structured phase. And they see that at some point there are these two vortices because they have a 0 to 2 pi phase winding around them. I will show it again, showing the nucleation of vortices in this kind of obstacle. Okay? Yeah, and in this experiment, they don't propagate very long, very far away, but they are there.
The reason the vortices are separating is because you still have a background superflow, so the vortices are being pushed apart.
I would say you have a background flow. I don't know if it's, you can call it superflow, but yes, this background flow is drifting the vortices away.
Well, there's a laminar flow.
Yes, you can put it like that. You have a laminar flow on top of which you have this perturbation.
But the vortices were sort of just like massive particles, then they would have to. I'm just surprised that it looks like you have viscosity in this thing because it's sort of they separate sort of linearly. They don't accelerate. Have you expected these things to be straight lines or parabolas?
No, I expect them to be to have an angle between them.
Just straight lines.
Yes, straight lines. Yes. But this picture changes because of the density change in this system. Eh? So maybe they will, instead of being straight lines, they will do some kind of parabolas.
Yeah, that's
okay. So we reduce even more the density. So kinetic energy now it's dominant. We still nucleate some kind of topological excitation, but in this case it is a different one. It's not a vortices. These are solids actually. So we have these dark lines here, and we have a phase jump right where the phase is located. I mean, the phase jump is located. Here's the phase jump in our walking away, and then you can see that the system the fluid. Comes back to a coherent state, and it is because we don't have any more the passage of these vortices, which is reducing the visibility of the fringes. Okay, so I want to show that this kind of behavior was predicted before we did this experiment by a group of Christian Occhiuti in this simulation. This is a simulation just like in the equation I just showed you before, and they were able to reproduce all the different regimes I just showed you: superfluidity, vortex formation, and soliton formation, both in density and phase. Okay. I will go back to the soliton picture again, just to address some more specific properties of the solitons. So here, this is a this is another experiment, but the idea is basically the same. Now we are pumping our system with a very high velocity, and this is the obstacle here, and you see these two very long solitons. And these two very long solitons, you have the face on here, allow us to analyze the solitons in a bit more detail. So by making cuts, you can actually see that there is a relationship between the soliton depth and the face, and we can even fit our solitons, maybe not the fit, but qualitatively we can fit them to this solitonic solution, which is a solitonic solution of the one-dimensional Grosskeeter equation, without losses. Okay, so I want to just to mention in this view graph that this experiment that we are doing with a CW laser, in a CW regime, in this experiment we can understand the solitons as 1D solitons in this direction, and actually the set direction can be understood as a time. Okay? Okay, and this will be important for what I'm going to show you after. So basically, what we are doing here, is analyzing the soliton evolution at different times, just by looking at different points in space.
I'm sorry, but I thought that in the previous slide you said that the density does not go down.
Yes, it does.
Yes.
Sorry, well, if I said that, I was wrong. So the soliton has characterized by a dip in the notch in the density, and a jump in the face across.
So what is the difference between vortex?
Well, the vortex is has a dip, a point like dip in the density. Okay, a point like dip in the density, and a phase winding of 2 pi around it in 2 dimensions. So a vortex would be, how will you go? I don't know if you can see it here, but we have a point dip in the density and a phase winding of 2 pi around it. Okay. So it's very different to this situation in which you have a dip, which is has this linear shape, okay, and then when you go around the.
I'm asking about your experiments. I mean, the figures you showed for vortex.
Yes, here this is the problem. Here is that it looks very similar. It looks very similar, but it is because in this experiment. We are doing this CW experiment, so we have these vortices which have a point like dip in the density, which are traveling around. So when you integrate in time, this point like objects traveling, you have overall you have a dark trace. But if you will be able to make a picture in time, you will see one vortex here, one vortex here, one vortex here, one vortex here, something like that. Okay, and a little bit later they will have moved. So when you integrate, you see this.
The solitons are not quantized, are they? In other words, if I look at the middle row of pictures,
yes,
and I compare the vortex.
Yes, the phase jump here between one side and the other side can be anything between 0 and pi. Anything. So there is a relationship, a one-to-one relationship between the depth of the soliton and the jump. So you have and also the velocity of the soliton.
The vortices are quantized.
The vortices are quantized. Yes. Okay. So this is the relationship I was talking about. So this is the relationship with the depth. This is the depth of the soliton, and this is the phase jump. Okay. So this is a relationship which comes just from this equation here, which is the equation of the soliton, and we actually verify. Okay, I'm not going into detail, but we verify that this relationship, which was obtained for equilibrium case,
also works
in our solitons, because again, we are thinking of them as one-dimensional solitons which evolve in time. So at each time, we can think of them as being in equilibrium. I don't know if this is very clear. Okay, if we look at momentum in space, we can actually see the currents that are related to the soliton. So the polaritons are flowing down, and when crossing the soliton, they change their direction a little bit, and then they come back to this laminar flow that we were talking about. And this you can see in momentum in space. So when you have no obstacle, if your gas is not, the gas is perturbed, so it moves with a well-defined momentum here. When you have the soliton, you have this new momenta that appear. This is integrated all over the image. which tells you that this new momentum component related to this flow up here. Okay, and then just to finish with the scalar solitons, we can also see that we can play with the kinetic energy and the interaction energy, and we take a big obstacle and we make the fluid flow very fast. We can actually nucleate 4 solitons instead of 2, as you can see in this image, for instance, or on the previous image. And this situation was actually predicted in the equilibrium case for atomic condensates in this work by Canzano and co-workers. Okay, we'll just spend 2 minutes on the stability. So actually, solitons, I don't know if you're familiar with these objects, they are unstable in two dimensions. So a one-dimensional soliton in 2 dimensions is unstable. And it is unstable because it's unstable with respect to transfer perturbations. So basically, this is what you have. You have this a soliton here, which is moving in this direction. And then if you create a little perturbation, this perturbation will propagate and will give rise to, well, it will make the soliton decay into this vortex first. And the reason why the solitons are unstable is actually written here. So this is the energy of the soliton. And if you analyze carefully this expression, you can see that when the velocity of the soliton increases, its energy decreases. Okay? And also its depth decreases. So actually, if I push it a little bit, it will like to gain more and more velocity. It will like to have a less and less depth. And this is why the solitons are unstable. So why can't we see these solitons in our experiments? Well, this was discussed very much by, actually, in the first place in this paper by Pitayevsky and Kapsanov in 2008, where they analyzed the stability of these solutions. And basically, the idea now is that you have a soliton which is absolutely unstable, but it is convectively stable. So if you make the fluid in which the soliton leaves move fast enough, actually your soliton will survive. And the reason is that here you have an obstacle here which is generating your soliton. And if you make your fluid move faster than the velocity of propagation of this instability, actually the instability will be drifted away and the soliton will be stable. Okay, and that is why we...
So in the left picture, the instability is not energy conserving somehow.
Well, actually, it goes into these vortices. Okay. So this is just a two-hand waving explanation. Okay. You have to go from this expression, which is the one that applies to the energy of the soliton, to the expression which actually includes the energy of the vortices. So it's conserved. It goes into the soliton, into the vortices. Sorry. So. In our case, so what they calculated is that the fluid should be 1.4 times the speed of sound in order for the drifting to be larger, stronger than the propagation of instability. And what we check in the polaritons is that actually at this point, next to the obstacle, the fluid speed is like 0.6 times the speed of sound. And what I have discussed very deeply with Kanchanov and also Pavlov is that. What happens is the way they interpret it is that actually here you might be subsonic, but this condition you achieve it here, and if you are not too far away where you achieve this condition, because the density again is going down, if you are not too far from the obstacle in the place where you achieve this condition, you can actually stabilize your soliton. Okay. So this is all for solitons in the scalar. Polariton fluids, but I would like now to introduce you to the spin of polaritons. So polaritons are off with a given spin, and this spin arises from the constituents. So the exciton has a spin because it's formed by electrons and by holes with a given spin. And actually, when you take the confined electrons and holes in the quantum well, the excitons you can form can have two different spin projections, two families of spin projections, plus minus one and plus minus two. Okay, these plus minus one are optically active, and these plus minus two are optically inactive. What it means active is that they can capitulate, and this one they cannot capitulate due to momentum conservation. So these are the photons. The photons have angular momentum plus minus one. As I told you, these photons can only couple to these excitons. So then when you have your exciton picture, I mean your polariton picture here, you have your excitons, plus minus two, plus minus one, these couple to the photons, and they give rise to this polariton. So polaritons actually have two possible spin projections, which are plus minus one. So this is the lower polariton branch, which is the one I was discussing all the time. This is the upper polariton branch. I will not discuss it in this section. But yes, I want just to tell you that these polaritons have these two possible spin projections. And these spin projections are related one-to-one to the polarization of the photons that escape out of the cavity. Because the photons have this angular momentum. This angular momentum is related to the polarization. Okay?
Sorry, but why photon has so big spin? So how would it be used?
Well, it comes from the fact that in the semiconductor, the valence band is formed by P states of the atoms that conform the semiconductor. The conduction band is formed by S states.
It is a coupling between the spin and the orbit, so
yes.
Strong spin orbit coupling.
Yes, yes.
So it is not spin, it is just the total moment.
Yes, it's total, sorry. It's total, sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry about this kind of words that I'm not always very careful about. Okay.
Sorry, but I don't understand. Maybe something wrong. So the combined spin of polariton is going to be, why is it one? Sorry, you're adding plus minus one photon, and exciton has one. So why don't you get two or zero?
I don't think you should add them. You should. And you don't add them there.
So the composite boson, the rule of spin addition, the composite bosons are.
It's superposition, not a bound state.
Right. Okay.
So this rule of the polarization, which maps the spin projection on the z-axis to these two polarization states, sigma plus sigma minus, the polarization, actually allow us to. This looks like a pseudo spin in 1/2 because we have two levels. So we can actually map the polarization in a Bloch sphere or a Poincaré sphere, if you want. In which the different points on the sphere indicate different polarizations. So here we have these two states, but if we have a state which is a linear combination of these two, we have, for instance, linear polarization in any given direction, so T, Tm, or the diagonal to the diagonal, or some elliptical polarization on a different point. Okay, so this is the first characteristic related to spin of polaritons, which is that they have two spin projections and they can be mapped in the Bloch sphere. Second one is that they have very strong spin-dependent interactions. And this gives rise to nonlinear spin phenomena. And just to give you a quick flavor of where this comes from, it comes from actually the combined effect of exciton interactions with the Lyman-Mather coupling. So the interactions in the polaritons, they all come from the exciton-exciton interactions. Okay? And this exciton-exciton interaction is dominated by the exchange process. So if I have parallel spins, the exchange term in the interaction, I will calculate it by taking this initial state and this final state, and the initial and final state are the same, and this interaction term, it's resonant, let's say, so it gives me some value of interaction. If I take polaritons with opposite spins, which means I take excitons with opposite spin, so I take this is my exciton plus one, my exciton minus one, when I calculate the exchange term, my final state is an exciton. I exchange electrons, for instance. My final state is an exciton with a plus minus two total spin, two of plus minus two total spin. And these excitons are not coupled to light. So when I consider the polariton picture here, so actually this process is non-resonant because the final state is not located at the same energy where my initial state was located, my polariton initial state. This final state is located here. It's located at the better exciton energy, where I have my plus two, minus two excitons. Okay? So this is a non-resonant process, and this makes the interaction between opposite spin to be very small compared to the interaction between polaritons of same spin. Okay? And this interaction, spin-dependent interaction, is fully, not fully, but almost fully governed by the Lyman-Mather coupling. So in normal excitons with same and opposite spin, they have almost the same interaction strength. In polaritons, this is completely changed by this Lyman-Mather coupling.
So is this an SZSZ interaction, or if I think that this is
I don't know what he means SZSZ interaction.
I mean, if I wrote down a Hamiltonian describing this in terms of some pseudospins, what's the form of that Hamiltonian?
I will tell you.
Okay.
Well, this is a summary of this idea. So U11, U22, this is the typical way you call them in atomic condensates are much bigger than U12. In strong contrast with, for example, Rubidium 87, in which U11, U22, and U12 are the same, almost the same.
I have the same question, but slightly differently. Yes. The idea is that the z-axis is defined by the Bragg condition of light.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Because
okay, I would. I don't have the slide on that I was thinking I would have on this.
Let me see if I can summarize it. You can tell me if this is correct. So there's a strong and up interaction, there's strong and down interaction, but the in, down, and up is weak. Sorry. And you don't have any terms that do this.
No. Right. Okay, third ingredient related to spin in polaritons, you can see it's very rich, is that we have, in this metal cavity, we have an intrinsic effective magnetic field that we lack on this pseudo spin of polaritons. And this intrinsic magnetic field arises from the dielectric properties of the micro cavity. So you have electric mirrors, you have some conditions on the boundaries related to the electromagnetic field, and when you take these conditions into account, you actually have that your polariton modes are not a polarization speaking related to the TE and TM polarization. TE polarization and TM polarization are the polarizations parallel and perpendicular to the propagation of your polaritons in the cavity. Okay? So these are actually the real eigenstates are like that. So when you look at your polaritons in the spin-up, spin-down picture, this splitting here results in an effective magnetic field acting on the pseudo spin. And this magnetic field can be plotted in this way. It's in the yellow arrows here. So for different momenta, for different directions, it points at different directions. And if I have a polariton, for instance, with an initial pseudo spin like that one, which means linearly polarized, for instance, like TM, polaritons moving in this direction will feel an effective magnetic field which is parallel to them, so nothing will happen to their spin. But polaritons moving in this direction with this cape, the pseudo spin will be perpendicular to this effective magnetic field, and this will induce a rotation of the spin. And so then you will see these kind of quadrants of, for instance, sigma plus, sigma minus polarization, even though in you initially put your spin linearly polarized spin without the circular components. So actually we can study this in this experiment that I'm going to show you here. So this a polariton condensate. Contrary to what I showed you before, this one is going to be excited non-rationally. So I'm going to excite it here. Due to the repulsion between polaritons, the condensate will expand. And so I'm putting it here and expanding all over the place in all directions. Okay. And if I look at the spin distribution of this expanding condensate, I see this different polarization. Okay, so my initial condensate was actually linearly polarized, and when it's expanding, it was linearly polarized in one direction, or probably in this direction. When it's expanding, it's seen this effective magnetic field, which has this particular form in the momentum space. So in different directions, the pseudo spin is rotating in different ways and give rise to this circularly polarized components here. Okay? And if I increase, for instance, the energy of the condensate, instead of having it here, I have it here, the splitting is higher, and I can actually see that the precession, there are more precessions in the same distance. Okay?
As I understand, this picture you obtained by looking at the excitations coming from excitons, right? Exciton part.
No. This is the polariton picture. This is fully the polariton picture. This is the light emitted by the cavity, by the polaritons from the cavity that are propagating away from where I found them. And as the polaritons move, their pseudo spin rotates. And very importantly is that this has nothing to do with interactions, with the polariton interaction. It has to do with the effective magnetic field. the interactions were related to the exciton component, but anyway, I'm looking at the polaritons. So I see these interactions via the polaritons. Electromagnetic field, it has fully to do with the photonic part, because it is the photonic part which has this seeking. Okay? Okay. Now, the idea is, okay, there are these very interesting or very rich, I would say, spin physics in polaritons. What can we say about this spin physics when we nucleate this hydrodynamic excitation? Okay? So this experiment that I showed you here, they are done with a sigma plus fluid, okay? With a purely sigma plus fluid, and these are scalar polaritons. So the idea is, if now I use, for instance, a linearly polarized fluid, so that I have 50% of my polaritons are sigma plus, 50% are sigma minus. Which form takes this topological excitation, this soliton excitation? So this is the equation that describes the system in this situation. This is not in the polariton picture; it's in the photon exciton picture. So this is the photon, the wave fraction of the photons. This is the coupling to the excitons. This is the lifetime of the photons. This is the pump. This is the effective magnetic field, which comes from this splitting. This is the wave function of the excitons. This is the coupling to photons. Okay, this is the term that couples the two equations. And these are the interactions, for instance. Interactions which are summarized here in this way. Okay? So when I look at this equation and I solve it for in particular conditions, what I obtain is this kind of picture in when looking at the polarization of the emission, okay? So I see that I have like two kind of like solitonic solutions, like the way I told them before, but they have a particular polarization pattern. So this is a cut in this direction, and what I can see is that in one polarization, one circular polarization, I have a soliton here, and in the other polarization, I have no soliton. Okay? So these solutions, which mix the spin, degree of freedom, and the phase, the phase topologies, we have called them half solitons, but they have been called half solitons by a group of Guillaume-Malpuel, and they can be seen in the following way. So these are I can consider I have two fluids, one sigma plus, one sigma minus. I inject them with the same amount of particles, so I can describe my fluid, my sigma plus fluid, with a wave function which looks like that, with a phase sigma plus. My wave function sigma minus with a phase sigma minus, and where this topological excitations have the following property. In one of the polarizations, I have a jump in the phase of pi, which is related to the dip in the soliton, and in the other polarization, there's no phase jump because the fluid is constant. Okay, so now we can do a change of basis. Like I can change the basis using this change here. And then I change the basis to the linear polarization basis. And then what I can see when I do this change of basis is that I can define a global phase, the phase of phi, and a polarization direction, linear polarization direction, in the system. Okay. And across the half soliton, what I see is that phase of jump of pi in my solitons, in one of the two polarizations, and zero in the other, goes back to a polarization rotation of pi over 290 degrees, looking at the linear polarization, and a phase jump of pi over. Okay, you will see this more clearly. So this is the experiment in which we try to address this situation. Here you have an obstacle, you have your fluid, we inject linearly polarized, and we look at the sigma plus sigma minus polarization. We see that a soliton forms here, for instance, which is almost absent in this polarization. Another way on this side. So on this side, you have a very clear soliton here. You have almost no soliton over there. And when we look at the phase jumps, for instance, we see have a very deep soliton, almost no soliton here. When we look at the phase jumps, we have a jump of almost pi in one of the components, for example, components, almost no pi, no jump on the other. This is the signature of the soliton. And we observe the complementary situation in the linear polarization. I will not go into it because I don't have much time. But so we can actually track the half soliton in this way. So the half solitons are characterized by a high degree of circular polarization, this red line, and by a change of polarization of linear polarization from, for instance, diagonal to anti-diagonal, as you can see in this green to to pink. Okay. Well, what I wanted to concentrate in the last 3 minutes that are left is on the fact that these haploidons actually behave like 1D monopoles, okay? 1D magnetic monopoles. And in order to show you that, I will concentrate on this image. This is the circular polarization experimentally obtained image when this nucleation of photons takes place, So I make a zoom to this region here, it's here. I make a zoom to this region. So this is one of the haploidons, which has a well-defined degree of circular polarization. I make a zoom here. This is the situation here. And I have this haploidon, which is characterized by this high degree of circular polarization. And then if I look at the direction of the linear polarization around, away from the haploidon, and this is marked by arrows here. Okay, so the arrow on this direction means diagonal polarization. Arrow in this direction means anti-diagonal polarization. So the polarization changes from diagonal to anti-diagonal when I cross it. When we look at this pseudo-spin representation here, I see that it is divergent. It diverges away from the solid. Okay, and a divergent field is the field you would expect from an effective charge. Okay, so this divergent field actually is in presence of a magnetic field, an effective magnetic field. This is the effective magnetic field I was telling you about before, that comes from the structure of the cavity. Okay, and this is the representation of the effective magnetic field. So this effective magnetic field has a projection in this direction perpendicular to the soliton, which is here, and this will actually magnetically act on the half soliton. So you don't need that. Okay, so now if I calculate the magnetic energy of the system here along this direction, the magnetic energy has this form. So this is the pseudo spin multiplied by the magnetic field, and I can see that to the left of the soliton, I have an effective field is pointing opposite to the pseudo spin texture. So I have this integral is positive because I have this minus sign here. So this magnetic energy is positive on this side. It is negative on this side because they are parallel, and I have the minus sign here. So actually, to minimize the energy, the system wants to push the half soliton to the left. So if I push it to the left, I minimize the energy because this side will gain weight. Actually, the half solitons have a negative mass, so actually this force that goes in that direction pushes the half soliton in the opposite direction. Okay, and you can actually understand what's going on here in this picture, taking that into account. So in the wake of the obstacle, what you nucleate is really a full soliton. Not, as you can see, as the composition, the superposition of two half solitons with opposite charges. And these opposite charges, in the presence of this magnetic field, will be accelerated in opposite directions. So one will come like that. The other one will come over here. So you see this negative, this polarization which is negative here. So you see the separation between these two half solitons, which arises from the, and you can see this even better here. This is one half soliton, this is the other half soliton, arises from this magnetic field, acting on. Okay. And I have a simulation here in which what we do is basically nucleate solve the equation I showed you before. We will do it first without this effective magnetic field present in the system, and then we see the sigma plus emission, sigma minus emission. You see the soliton form, and we put the magnetic field in the equation in the simulation. You see that these solitons are accelerated in the way they should.
Sir, going back to the question I asked earlier.
Yes.
And now, since you're saying accelerated, yes. So these things are accelerated if there's a curvature, and if it's straight line, it's not really accelerated,
right,
because there's friction. So can you distinguish?
No, it's not because there's friction.
Or. I guess, at least with vortices, I understand that if you think of a vortex in the background flow, then there's a force that's proportional to the separation, so it looks like gravity, so it should be terrible. The separation between of the vortex and the vortex pair as it flows down should be parabolic.
Because of the interaction between them?
Because of the Magnus force. The Magnus force is proportional.
Yes.
It's a force it's a constant force.
Okay, this would be the case for the vortices. I don't think it's the case for the solid ones. But in this case, acceleration, the deviation from the linear element comes from this electromagnetic field. Okay, maybe it's a different origin. Okay, I don't have time to tell you that these half solitons actually they behave like Coulomb objects which repel each other, and we have done some simulations which show that. But we're just going to the conclusion. So just to summarize, I showed you some scalar properties, aerodynamic properties of these polaritons and superfluidity, formation of these solitons, and also of these mixed spin phase objects. And what we're going to do to try to do now is to study this Coulomb-like interactions with these half solitons in one-dimensional configuration. And actually, the LPN, the laboratory where I work now, is specialized in polaritons in lower dimensionalities. So basically, we grow samples now that we etch, and we etch them in very different configurations. For instance, in these one-dimensional wires, where we can accelerate polaritons and observe their interactions. We can also etch them in pillars, macro pillars, so we can create a zero-dimensional structure where we can condense the polaritons and look at interactions and reduce the dimensionality. We can do periodic potentials, as you can see here, and we have a very nice work now that is we're trying to submit soon on the formation of gap solitons in these periodic potentials. And we can also, for instance, create coupled polariton condensates by coupling this micropylon here, and we have observed just Jespersen oscillations, and actually we have observed nonlinear just Jespersen oscillations on these pillars, and a phenomenon like self-trapping, for instance, in one of the pillars. Okay, and with this I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. So we had already many questions on this.
Can you point us to some situation where the Gross-Peterewski equation fails horribly in describing the system?
Yes, well, the Gross-Peterewski equation fails when you include the reservoir, and I think that Jonathan is an expert on this. He's going to probably tell you about this, because you have some interaction. But this is like in condensates. In atomic condensates also, when you have you include the reservoir effects, Gross-Peterewski doesn't include the reservoir, right? So you need you want to include temperature or non-condensed atoms, you need something else. So there has been several stronger efforts to understand the link between the condensed state and the cloud of uncondensed excitons that you may have in your system. I showed situations in which basically this uncondensed cloud is not present or is strongly minimized. So you are closer to using the Gross-Peterewski equation. But another important thing is that you need you have the decay, okay? And when you have the decay, this changes subtlety, but importantly, many properties. For instance, superfluidity. So you look at the spectrum of excitations of your fluid in the presence of decay, you will see that in the situations in which you would usually have superfluidity, a linear spectrum of excitation, this you can actually almost never find in your equation. You will find situations in which your spectrum of excitation is flat around k equals zero. Okay, it's flat. It's not like in atomic condensates, which is linear. It is flat, and then it becomes linear. Okay, this is a characteristic. This arises from the decay. Okay. So this will tell you that you could not actually have like superfluidity in the same sense that you have it in the equilibrium case. But still, another subtlety that arises from that is that if you take into account the imaginary part, then you have a strong damping. So you can actually recover in a qualitative way the superfluid features thanks to this damping. So if you want, I can discuss it with you later in more detail, but these are one of the situations in which this Gross-Peterewski equation is very different in our system due to the decay. So then when you consider the
superfluid.
Stop,
we might be, I want to get back to the speed thing, so then we'll move it. So the reason why you got this effective spin is that the photon in the cavity, there is a splitting between the two modes, the TM and PT. So it's the photon that brings then the polariton.
Well, the eigenstates you forget about the d-team splitting is it's something that acts on the on the on the photon and it gives it to the polarizer.
So that's the reason why you got two polarizations, so you don't get three polarizations.
Yes, you are right, absolutely. That's right, yes, okay. Exactly, that's right.
You mean plus one, minus one, and not yes. zero?
Yeah, yes. Or zero, right, I guess.
Yes, because you have the coupling with
light. It's the photon, so.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Okay.
How does the average interaction energy here compare to the 100 picosecond lifetime?
You want me to give you a number in time scale?
If you know it, or just the ratio, or, you know. And basically, how many times do these guys interact before they disappear?
Ah, okay. Yes. I think you can get it from the splitting. So I don't have the figure in the head. I mean, but the splitting in energy is actually giving you this. So the more they not really the splitting.
You want to compare the blue shift to the line width.
Yes, yes.
And the blue shift is a couple of MeV, and the line width is about 0.2 MeV, half an MeV.
Yes, that's the point. So. So you have not. Why not? You have like around 20 MeV or like 10 MeV compared to 0.1 MeV. So it's like 100 times, even more, I would say.
I have a question. This accelerating monopoles, they probably should emit something.
What do you mean emit?
Accelerating.
Because the point is that these are not monopoles. These are objects that behave like monopoles. I would say it in a more precise way. They are effective. They are objects that behave like having an effective charge in the presence of an effective magnetic field, an effective magnetic field. So then they behave like having like a monopole, but they have no charge, and the magnetic field is not a real magnetic field.
Maybe I had a little kind of confusion. So normally solitons are understood as kind of step-like objects, right? Whereas you have some kind of leap.
Well, maybe there are different contexts in which you can consider solitons. Solitons in a gravity-test equation or in a Cayley-Three optics equation, they have the form I show you when you consider the space of solitons.
Yes, tangent.
Yes, hyperbolic tangent.
Yeah, so
no, but
solitons and solitons.
Yes, maybe you need to consider it like that.
So then it's a laser.
It's
a yes. I don't know where I have it, but yes, it's the standard graph test soliton.
Okay, thank you very much.